Okay, so let me remind you. In this course, we will very carefully study the field theory of the Klein-Gordon field and then quantize it. And we do it very carefully because we will need to do it on an expanding space-time or on a Schwarzschild background and other non-trivial scenarios. So we will have to do it very carefully. But that's a little slow. And therefore, for at the very beginning of the course, and including today, I give you an overview of the structure of quantum field theory and what we can expect and where the tricky parts arise. So this is a quick run-through, but then not from the next lecture, but the one afterwards, we will go very systematically. So if this feels a little rushed, a little fast, could be, but it's not meant to be the systematic introduction just yet. So remember the picture of a lake with its waves, and we said that at every point of the lake, there's a harmonic oscillator. The waves can bob up and down. However, these oscillators are not independent oscillators. We know that because if we excite one, for example, by throwing a stone in there, then we are not only going to excite an up-down bobbing there, but no, this will spread, which means that these harmonic oscillators, one at every point, these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. And we identify that in the Klein-Gordon equation, that is accomplished through the spatial derivatives. The spatial derivatives couple the harmonic oscillators to each other. Here is the Klein-Gordon equation again. Pi hat dot is, of course, phi double dot, second derivative. And just to remind you again of this, imagine the second derivative, this Laplacian operator, wasn't there. What do we have then? Then we have the second time derivative of the amplitude at x is equal to minus m squared the amplitude at x. That means second time derivative equal to minus a constant times the field itself, times the amplitude, which means for every x we have a harmonic oscillator, right? Second time derivative is proportional to minus the original amplitude. So at every point we have a harmonic oscillator, and this thing here is coupling harmonic oscillators. This is what makes the spread of waves.
Is the idea that the Laplacian connects only, let's say, nearest neighbor oscillators, and if I had higher derivative theories, I would connect next to nearest neighbor terms?
Yes and no. If you discretize space, then higher derivatives mean further and further neighbors. But if you keep the continuum, then any finite power of derivatives, even if you take the 27th power, it's still local. If you use infinitely many powers, then you get translation operators and related things, and they can be a finite distance. But remember, if you calculate even the 100th derivative of a function, you only need to know it in the infinitesimal neighborhood. But if you discretize space, then you turn derivatives into finite differences, and yes, it's going to be next to next neighbors if you discretize space. All right, so now this Laplacian here looks harmless, and so yeah, it's nice to see that, but it will play a crucial role for inflation, for cosmic inflation. And the reason is that, well, there's going to be a cosmological horizon due to the exponential expansion or almost exponential expansion, and that will mean that actually this thing can dominate over that and change the sign so that we have no longer harmonic oscillator. So just be prepared that this is not necessarily so for a quantum field theory in extreme circumstances, such as an expanding space-time. And again, we will do that systematically. Okay, so where we arrived last time was this. We said that quantization means keeping the equations of motion the same in the Heisenberg picture. The hermeticity conditions translates in the obvious way. So if, for example, a field is real valued, then the quantized field is assumed to be self-adjoint operator valued, because that's the analog to realness. And what's new with the quantization is that we now require that the field in its and its canonically conjugate field to obey these canonical commutation relations. Now let's remember what the canonically conjugate field is. So we have at every point a harmonic oscillator. So we hold x fixed, and then we have a harmonic oscillator phi of t. And its time derivative, so phi dot, is the momentum with which the amplitude is changing, right? And that's the canonically conjugate field, the pi. The pi is, at least in Minkowski space, it is just phi dot. Again, we should expect that that doesn't carry forward, not at least in this simple way, when spacetime is curved, when we have a black hole or inflation or things like that. And in fact, the relationship between the canonically conjugate field and, I mean, how it is expressed in terms of derivatives of phi is going to be quite non-trivial, and we will have to work that out. Okay, so what we need to solve a quantum field theory, such as the Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space-time, is this. We will need to solve these canonical commutation relations together with these equations of motion. And remember that pi equal to phi hat dot, that's an equation of motion as well. And this one is the Klein-Gordon equation. And then we also need to obey, as the third condition, the hermeticity condition that phi is phi star, or once quantized, phi is phi dagger. So remember, always, when you solve a quantum field theory, you have to do three things. You have to find phi hat of x and t and pi hat of x and t that, first, obey the canonical commutation relations, second, obey the equation of motion, third, obey the hermeticity condition. Now, I left you with a little exercise last time. Namely, we saw at the end of the last lecture that these two equations, the equations of motion for phi dot and for pi dot, these two equations of motion follow as Heisenberg equations. Heisenberg equations, again, remember, in every quantum theory, whether this is quantum mechanics or quantum field theory, has this property that if f hat of t is some observable, could be position operator or angular momentum operator in quantum mechanics, or it could be the phi at a phi hat at a particular location, the time derivative of this is equal to the commutator of the f hat of t with h hat of t, where this is the Schrödinger and the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So if the claim was that if you use this Hamiltonian and plug it in here, and then choose for f either the field or the canonically conjugate field, then you get these two equations of motion. One of them, I think this one, I showed you actually the derivation of it, and the other one I left to you to prove. Okay, so the general principle is that the Klein-Gordon equation is no longer the starting point in second quantization. The Klein-Gordon equation is derived. It's derived from this Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian with the above commutation relations gives us the equations of motion for phi hat and for pi hat, and those two equations of motion are these two. Namely, IH bar phi hat dot is commutator of phi with h here, and IH bar pi hat dot is commutator of pi with h. Just work out what that is. If you plug in the Hamiltonian into here and then work out the commutators, which is not trivial because you're going to get, from the commutator, you're going to get Dirac deltas. But the Hamiltonian has an integral, and the integral will eat up the Dirac delta, and so you end up deriving these two equations here. I very much recommend doing that little calculation. So in the previous lecture, I reminded you of some properties of harmonic oscillators. Then we considered relativistic fields, rederived equal mc squared and stuff like that. And then we started second quantization. We arrived here. So now, Let us look at harmonic oscillators in fields. Those guys. That are at every point you have a harmonic oscillator. So from here, we know that we need to solve the following equations. We need to solve the Klein-Gordon equation for phi. Once we have the phi hat, of course, then the pi hat follows easily because this equation of motion is so simple, right? So once we have phi hat, once we have a solution to this, then the pi hat follows immediately by just taking the derivative of it. But we also, we don't just have to solve this. We have to solve it together with the canonical commutation relation that phi doesn't commute with its time derivative. So how can we solve these equations? How can we solve for a Hermitian, for a self-adjoint valued, operator-valued field phi hat of x and t that obeys this equation of motion and this commutation relation? What we can use here is the similarity to harmonic oscillators. And remember, we identified the similarity to harmonic oscillators. For example, here we can see it again. If we drop the spatial derivatives, we have the second time derivative of phi is equal to minus m squared phi. So that's a harmonic oscillator for each choice of x. So infinitely many harmonic oscillators, one for every point in space. So that should be useful. But we should also anticipate that it's not quite trivial because this thing is actually there. So we have to take that into account. So we will use the similarity to harmonic oscillators, but for that we will have to overcome a few technical difficulties. So let's go through those. What are they and how can they be overcome? Here's the first technical difficulty. Let us look at the Klein-Gordon equation again. Here it is. And we know that its analogy is to the harmonic oscillators, right? So the harmonic oscillator equation would be the time derivative of the momentum is minus some backdriving force constant, some spring constant, times the elongation of the harmonic oscillator. And if we have a lot of harmonic oscillators, then we might label their positions and momenta with a label little a. So this is a bunch of a lot of harmonic oscillators labeled by a with potentially different spring constants. Here too, we have not just one harmonic oscillator, we have a ton of them. We have continuously infinitely many of them, namely one for every location x. Remember, I'm not writing a vector symbol on this or boldface x. It's still three-dimensional. So this is supposed to be the analogy where the role of the k is played by the m squared. But this thing is in the way because that's not a number. That cannot act as a spring constant. The m squared is like a spring constant, even with the right sign, but this one isn't. So what can we do? What we need here is numbers, not derivatives. Because if this was a number, it would be easy. It would be really just a harmonic oscillator for every x. But we know that there is an important reason for why this is a derivative and not a number, because this is supposed to couple the neighboring harmonic oscillators. As we discussed before, if you discretize space, then the derivative operator becomes a finite difference operator. You know, it's just like the Newton-Leibniz limit for the formula for the derivative, but you don't take the limit, right? Then you have a finite approximation to what the derivative is on the lattice. So we need that, because otherwise, without that term, waves would not spread. So we cannot make an approximation where this thing is absent or something like that. That would be a terrible approximation. It would be approximating that waves cannot spread. So is there perhaps some mathematical method by which derivatives become numbers? And there is, of course, and that's the Fourier transform. Remember that under Fourier transform, derivatives become numbers. So the idea is that we take the Schrödinger, not the Schrödinger, the Klein-Gordon equation, and we Fourier transform it in space. We could also do a time Fourier transform, but that would not help. In fact, it would confuse things a bit. So let's just do a spatial Fourier transform. And we expect that if we do that, this Laplacian becomes number valued. Now, before we actually do it, and we will do it in all detail, let's think a little bit about what we should expect. So we perform this trick that we do a Fourier transform of the Klein-Gordon equation, and we expect that this becomes number valued then. But if it does, let's say the Fourier transform variable to x is p or k, let's say it's k, then we would expect that here we have a k squared. So then we would have a k squared plus m squared. Then, yes, this is number valued. Then the analogy with the harmonic oscillators is complete. And we would really just have a bunch of independent harmonic oscillators because there's no longer any derivatives between them. Does this make sense? And I think I mentioned it already in the previous lecture, or maybe the lecture before, that this makes perfect sense. Because when we Fourier transform, our harmonic oscillators are no longer in x space. No, now we have one harmonic oscillator for every value of k, for every momentum. And you see, if we have a field with waves, then if you excite one of its oscillators in momentum space, then it is not coupled to its neighbors. In momentum space, waves do not spread. For example, I could take a laser pointer and create a wave of a particular wavelength, so a particular k vector. Now, is that going to spread to other k vectors? So if I emit a green laser light, let's say, does that flow apart and become red and blue as well? No, it doesn't, right? In momentum space, the waves maintain their momentum. It's momentum conservation. Waves don't have position conservation. They spread, but they have momentum conservation, right? So that actually makes sense. If we Fourier transform waves, then they no longer spread. A wave of a particular wavelength maintains that wavelength, maintains that frequency. I'm making so much fuss about it because later in this course, it's no longer going to be true. Because there, you know, if you say, let's say you take a laser pointer and you shoot a green laser beam out into the universe, well, the universe is expanding underneath it, which stretches it and makes it red and then infrared and so on. So what we should expect is that this little Fourier trick is going to work now, but not later. Okay, so we will have to be clever about it later on. So for now, this is going to work. So here's a little visualization. As long as we work in position space, we have at every point a harmonic oscillator, and these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other through the Laplacian derivatives. And that means that excitations spread. On the other hand, if we Fourier transform, for example, if we take this particular lake with its wave, with its waves on it, then we can Fourier transform that. And we might find a picture like this. It could be that even though it's hard to see with a naked eye, it could be that there are some predominant waves, some predominant wavelengths. And then in the Fourier transform, they would show up like this, for example. Yes, there are sort of all sorts of frequencies, all sorts of wavelengths are present, but there may be some dominant ones. But the thing is that even though in position space stuff spreads and so on, in momentum space that would be stable because the waves don't change their wavelength. Actually, with actual ocean waves, it's not exactly like that because they are not harmonic. It turns out that the wavelength, the frequency, and so on, they depend on the amplitude of the wave. But for small water waves, it's pretty much harmonic. Yeah. All right, so let's do the trick. Let's do a Fourier transform of the spatial variables x1, x2, and x3. So we take the field phi hat of x and t, we multiply it with the Fourier factor, and then integrate over. And of course, in order to make the Fourier transform fully proper, we also have to divide by, we have to also multiply with 2 pi to the power of minus 3 half. We are setting h bar equal to 1 here. That is to say, we are choosing units such that h bar takes the value 1 in these units. Because otherwise, we would have to divide by an h bar here, and there would be an h bar in there. Now, I'm writing this down as if it was the normal, a very normal thing to do. But it's not. Because remember that these phi hat are not number values. So we are Fourier transforming something that's not number valued. What are we really doing here? Well, at every x, we have a harmonic oscillator. So for every x, the phi hat of t is an operator that is like the elongation of a harmonic oscillator. And we know that in quantum mechanics, our canonically conjugate pairs of variables need to be represented as operators. In the simplest case, as matrices, like infinite by infinite matrices. So we should expect that here too, because we have these quantization conditions, the phi hat of x and t takes its values not in the complex numbers, but in operators. And that's the case. The phi hat of x and t, well, we haven't actually solved for one yet, but if we did solve for it, we should expect that for every choice of x and t, this is actually an operator. And in a suitable choice of bases, it might be an infinite by infinite matrix. So what we're really doing here is Fourier transforming a function which takes its arguments among R3 and R, x and t, but its values in infinite by infinite matrices, if you choose a basis. Basis independently, we can just say it's an operator. So what does the Fourier transform then mean? Well, the Fourier transform means we do the Fourier transform of every component, of every matrix element of this infinite by infinite matrix. So far, we haven't done that yet, but we should anticipate that this is what we need to do. It's not a big deal. You can just straightforwardly always do that. And the reason why we don't really need to worry about this, and this is not a big deal, is that the Fourier transform is a linear operation, and so is choosing a basis. Now you take an operator, it's just linear algebra, really. And therefore, these two things usually commute with each other. In other words, it doesn't matter whether you first Fourier transform and then choose a basis, or first choose a basis and then Fourier transform. Also because the Fourier transform is a very well-behaved linear operation. It's a unitary operation. As such, it's bounded, it's continuous, so it doesn't really harm choices of bases. So when we do the Fourier transform, then instead of having phi hat of x and t, we have phi hat of k and t, where k is the 3 momentum. Now, for reasons unknown, researchers are still working on this, the notation is not that we put a k here, but we put the k as an index. It makes no sense, but this is just in cosmology, and people do it this way. So instead of writing phi hat of k, comma t, they write phi hat index k, comma t. It's exactly the same thing, but all right, so that's the notation here. Also, the Fourier transformed Klein-Gordon field, phi hat of k and t, is also called a mode. For every choice of k, it's called a mode. It's the k mode. You hold k fixed, and then you have a k mode. And it makes sense to give it a name, because each one of them is independently a harmonic oscillator. It doesn't actually couple to its neighbors. Remember that in Minkowski space, if you create a red wave, it stays red forever. So the momentum is conserved, always the same. Just because phi hat of k is excited, for example, if that harmonic oscillator was excited, it doesn't mean that the neighbors get excited as well. So they're independent, and as such, they're called the k modes. In some circumstances, such as expanding spacetimes, these guys are coupled to each other because, you know, the wavelengths can change over time. Then they would still be called modes. And when you then do a further trick to decouple them again from each other, decoupled harmonic oscillators are also called normal modes. So in this case, they are not only modes, they are normal modes because they are decoupled from each other. They obey independent differential equations. Or mathematically speaking, what used to be a partial differential equation, namely the Klein-Gödel equation, became infinitely many ordinary differential equations that depend only on one derivative, namely the time derivative. Okay, now this operation is invertible. We can Fourier transform back. And the Fourier transform is, of course, obtained by taking the phi hat k of k and t and then multiplying with this Fourier factor now without a minus sign here. So the forward Fourier transform to momentum space has a minus sign. The Fourier transform back to position space has no minus sign. But the Fourier factors here in front are the same. By the way, if you ever look up Fourier transform stuff, and I will later ask you to do that if you're not already familiar with it, then you might stumble upon formulas in the literature that look different. Namely, where instead of having 2 pi to the power minus 3 half, you simply have 2 pi to the power of minus 3 for one Fourier transform, and then for the other, you don't have any factor. That's how engineers usually do it. But mathematicians and physicists prefer this. And the reason is that with these prefactors, the Fourier transform is a unitary map in the Hilbert space. So otherwise, it's not. And so this is just a natural thing to do. But if you look up formulas in formula collections of Fourier transforms, just watch out for the prefactors. All that can happen is that you're wrong by a power of 2 pi, but it's still a nuisance to be wrong by a factor of 2 pi. Okay, so what we now can do is this. Now that we have the inverse Fourier transform, we can take that formula that expresses phi of x in terms of the phi of k and plug it into all the equations that we had before. Right? So you take this equation. Oh, now it just disappeared. So we can take this equation here, remember that it expresses phi of x in terms of that Fourier integral, in terms of phi k. And now we plug it into all of the stuff that we had before, namely, rather here, up here. Right here, we have phi of x. We express it in terms of the Fourier transform of phi of k. The pi is just the time derivative of that. So again, we can express that in terms of the Fourier transform of the derivative of phi. And then here, we express that in terms of the Fourier transform, this one, that, and that. And then also these equations, everything here, all of this can be re-expressed in terms of phi of k simply by plugging, by substituting the phi of x everywhere through its Fourier transform. Now, when we do that, then we obtain the following. We obtain that the canonical commutation relations look like this. So phi hat of k commutator with phi with pi hat of k prime, etc., is this, and so on. We also have that the Hamiltonian can be expressed in this form. Remember how you do it? You just take the Hamiltonian as we had it before, and you express every occurrence of phi hat of x in terms of phi hat of x as the Fourier transform of phi k of phi hat of k. And then, you know, you just work out the various integrals and you end up with this formula here. I'd like to leave this to you as an exercise to just show these things. It's instructive to go through the motions and see how all of these things work out. All right, so in momentum space, that's what we get. The Hamiltonian is this, these commutation relations, and these equations of motion. And again, we can use this Heisenberg equation here. And then we can take, for example, for f, we can take phi hat of k, plug it into here. That gives us the time derivative. Phi hat of k in there. And here the Hamiltonian expressed in momentum space. And if we do that, then using the canonical commutation relations, we derive these equations of motion. This is for phi hat of k. For pi hat of k, we can also use the Heisenberg equation here. Now, something is much better here compared to what it was when we expressed everything still in position space. Let us look at the Hamiltonian to start with. What we see is no more derivatives. For every k, this is a harmonic oscillator, right? It's a pi squared plus, and then we have a phi squared with some prefactor here. So it looks like what we have here is just the integral over harmonic oscillators that are independent of each other, because there's no derivative, no k derivative. We used to have a Laplacian in the Hamiltonian before. Now we don't, because as promised, the Laplacian becomes k squared. And remember, k squared is k vector squared, really, right? Because the Laplacian is the sum of the second derivatives. So the Fourier transform of it is the sum of the second powers. OK, so it seems that we have achieved what we wanted to achieve. The Hamiltonian is the sum of the energies of independent harmonic oscillators, Hamiltonians. The canonical commutation relations look fine. And the Klein-Gordon equation has no longer any derivatives in it. It's literally a harmonic oscillator for every value of k, where this is the back-driving force constant. Second time derivative is proportional to the amplitude. Or is it? See, it looks good, but no, there are actually some troubles in this, some difficulties that we will have to overcome. It's not as easy as saying that, OK, this is the backdriving force constant, so this is omega squared, so omega, the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, square root of k squared plus m squared. We get kind of that result, but it's not as easy. So let's see what the difficulties are. And then let's overcome them. So as I said, you can derive these equations of motion in the Fourier transform picture from these Heisenberg equations of motion. And that's what I wrote up here as an exercise. Use the Hamiltonian and the canonical commutation relations together with the Heisenberg equation of motion to derive these the Klein-Gordon equation and this relationship between pi and phi dot. OK, so we overcame so far one difficulty. The first difficulty was that we had the space derivatives. And with these space derivatives, we could not get ordinary uncoupled harmonic oscillators. The Fourier transform solved that problem. But now we have the second difficulty. Namely, what we notice is that the canonical commutation relations have a Dirac delta of k plus k prime. And that's not a Kronecker delta. So ordinarily in quantum mechanics, we have that canonically conjugate variables don't commute. But what we have on the right-hand side is ih bar, not ih bar times infinity. But that's what we have here. It seems that we have an infinity here, because the Dirac delta is like infinity if the argument is 0, and otherwise it is 0. So how can we work with that? How can we turn that into a Kronecker delta? See, because if we have here a Dirac delta, then we cannot use what we know from ordinary harmonic oscillators. Because for an ordinary harmonic oscillator, the canonical commutation relations between its q and its p are ih bar, not ih bar times infinity. So here the idea is this. We discretize momentum space. So the trouble arises because the momentum variables are continuous. They're R3. They're from R3. But if we could discretize momentum space, then we should get Kronecker deltas here. But how can one discretize momentum space? If you have a function over R, or you have a function over R3, then the Fourier transform is also a function over R3, right? Automatically. So if X space is like, if the position space is R3, then the momentum space is also R3. But we want a discrete momentum space. Now, if you remember, there is an important principle from Fourier theory. And if you're not completely familiar with what I'm saying now, then please look it up, but be aware of the square root of pi factors. If your function lives not on R3, but if it lives only in an interval or in R3, only in a box, if your function lives only in a box, then you don't need to do a Fourier transform. You can do a Fourier series transform. And a Fourier series transform only goes over discrete values of momentum. Remember that? If you have a function over the real line, then its Fourier transform is also living over the real line. If position space is R, momentum space is also R. But if the position space is only an interval, then the Fourier space is discrete. You have a Fourier series in this case. So the idea is that we will replicate that here. We will say, what if the part of the universe that we want to describe is only a box of side length L? Then I should be able to get away with a Kronecker delta here, if I'm careful with this, because I'm getting a discretized momentum space. But then you might say, well, but the universe is not a box. Who knows what happens at the boundary of the box? To that I reply, what if I make that box really large? Let's say I make this box 500 billion light years across. In that case, yes, whatever happened at the boundaries had no time to travel to us. The universe is only 13.8 billion years old. So we can always make the box so large that whatever we say happens at the boundary, there could be Dirichlet boundary conditions where the field has to vanish, or periodic boundary conditions, or whatever. Whatever happens, it doesn't matter for the physics that we are interested in here. Now, artificially assuming that the physics happens only in a box is called, has a name, and the name is infrared cutoff. Now, the word cutoff is kind of clear, right? Because we are cutting off the rest of the universe. But why is it called infrared? So you see, this goes back to the old idea that the visible spectrum is like this. You have red, and then you have green, and then you have blue. And then if this is the frequencies, nu, and then above the blue, you have ultraviolet. And then above that, you have, of course, you know, X-rays and so on. And in frequency lower than red, you then have infrared. And then, of course, eventually it goes into radio and so on, radio waves. But the point is that if you want to do a large wave, then this is towards large wavelengths. And this is towards short wavelength, right? High frequencies, short wavelengths. And this is low frequencies, long wavelengths. And if we cut off the wavelengths, and that's what we do when we put things in a box, because that means we are not emitting any wavelengths larger than L. So the idea is that if you assume that, if you decide that we want to describe only the physics in a box up to a certain maximum wavelength, then we call this an infrared cutoff because we are making a cutoff in this direction. We're saying, okay, for long wavelengths we cut off. Later we will also encounter a different kind of cutoff, the so-called ultraviolet cutoffs, and that's we say we do an ultraviolet cutoff if we decide not to try to describe the physics of wavelengths shorter than a certain wavelength. But for now, we are only doing an infrared cutoff. So we will describe only the physics within a box of side lengths L. So the box goes from minus L half to L half in the x direction, in the y direction, in the z direction. Yeah?
So is the idea that if you artificially put it in this large box, the longer the wavelength, the more we like don't get like, well, I don't see like the immediate connection between the...
Well, we put it in a box knowing that whatever might have happened outside the box cannot interest us, right? It cannot have affected us. Now, that's the motivation of it. The mathematics of it is that there are not going to be any wavelengths larger than this.
Okay.
Right? So that's just the mathematics of it.
Don't have support outside.
Hmm? Yeah, yeah. The functions don't have a support outside, but also we restrict the Fourier transform to this. So we say the functions live only in there. It's as if we pretended the universe was actually only that size. Yeah, and then we have to decide what boundary conditions to choose at the boundary. And it doesn't matter because we choose those boundaries so far away that whatever happened there, it had no time to reach us yet. But mathematically, we need some description. And one description, the one that is very popular because it has some technical advantages, is to choose periodic boundary conditions. So it is as if the universe was made out of equal boxes forever, right? It's just periodic boundary conditions. You can think of it as one box, but whatever goes out one side comes in immediately the other side. So periodic boundary conditions are very popular in the research literature for reasons that we will later see. Unfortunately, they come with their own technical difficulties. And we will get back to that. There are pros and cons for different choices of boundary conditions. So the advantage of this is that now that the space is finite in extent, we don't need to do a Fourier transform. We only need to do a Fourier series transform. And as I said, this is called an infrared cutoff or infrared regularization. Regularization in physics is a term that's often used when we encounter something that's infinite and we want to force it to become finite, such as the right-hand side of the canonical commutation relations. The Dirac delta wants to be infinite where it peaks. It's either zero or infinite. It's actually not defined, right? So we want to regulate that by doing something that will make that finite or preferably even the Kronecker delta. That's what we do here. So it's called infrared cutoff or infrared regularization. That's the same thing. Infrared cutoff and infrared regularization are the same thing. So how does this work, this infrared regularization? Well, what we will have is that the momentum values are now discretized. This is all coming from the theory of Fourier series rather than Fourier transform. What we have is that the Fourier transform of a function that lives in the box is no longer a function that lives in R3 and in R3 momentum space. It lives on a discrete lattice of momenta. And you can think of it this way, that in a box, let's say with periodic boundary conditions, not every momentum can exist, right? You only have certain standing waves in a box, right? You have, in a box, you can have a wave that goes like this. You can have a wave that goes like this, or a wave that goes like three times or four times and so on. But you can't have a wave that solves the periodic boundary conditions which goes like, I don't know, 3.742 times in there. It doesn't work. It will not obey the boundary conditions. So what we have is that for periodic boundary conditions, the momenta that are occurring in the Fourier series are all of the form 2 pi over L times n1, n2, n3, where these numbers are integers. The volume of the box is, of course, L to the third power. And now the Fourier series expansion is the following. We now take our function phi, which, remember, lives only in the box, only in the volume V, and we multiply it with the usual Fourier factor. But the k are taken from this set of triplets only, right? So the k values are no longer taken from arbitrary R3 momentum space, but from a discretized momentum space where all the allowed momenta are of this form. And then we calculate the Fourier transform, but the function lives only in the box, so we only integrate over the box from minus L half to L half, minus L half to L half, and so on. And then here we have 1 over the square root of the volume, 1 over the square root of L to the third power, that is. So that's the forward Fourier transform, and we obtain here the Fourier coefficient. And that's a discrete set of Fourier coefficients. I'm having the hats here because we are doing this for quantum fields, but you could do the same thing without the hats for classical fields. Remember, the only difference is that if these are matrix-valued functions, then this is a Fourier transform for every matrix element individually. All right, so that's the forward Fourier transform. It looks very similar to what we used to have. We used to have that we integrated over all of R3. And we used to have that this was actually 1 over square root of 2 pi to the power of 3. But now we have a volume factor here, and we integrate only over the volume. Other than that, the forward transform is the same as before. But the backward transform is now different because it's the Fourier series. If we now want to reconstruct what the field does in the volume V, then this is the formula for it. We get, again, the volume prefactor, so that's L to the power 3 to the power minus 1 half. And then here we have these coefficients, and that's a discrete set of them. These k values are taken from this grid of k values, you know, running through all the integers here. And then here the Fourier factor. So that's the backward Fourier series transform. If you're not familiar with this, please look it up. It's very commonly used in applied physics and in engineering. So now that we've decided to look not at the entire universe as a whole, but just at an arbitrarily large chunk of it of size L by L by L, now the Hamiltonian takes this form. It's now a sum over 1 half momenta squared plus omega squared half and then the amplitude squared. Very similar to having, in ordinary quantum mechanics, just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. It's just infinitely many of them. But it's no longer uncountably. It's no longer continuous infinitely many. It's now countably infinitely many. That's much better to handle. And I introduced the terminology or the notation here that omega k squared is k squared plus m squared. Because remember that this is playing the role of the spring constant, and therefore it determines the frequency. Mm-hmm.
I still have a problem of grasping why having a continuous infinite k is a problem.
It's because in the quantization you have the Dirac delta here,
okay.
Right? And that means that even if you can claim that for every k I have a harmonic oscillator, it's not a harmonic oscillator of the kind that we treated in quantum mechanics. Because there, the q and the p of the harmonic oscillator have a commutation relation that has on the right-hand side ih bar, and not ih bar times infinity.
You wanted to reach this analogy because, you know,
yes.
Physics right there.
Exactly. I want to not have to solve everything from scratch. I just want to reduce it to actual harmonic oscillators so that we can then recruit all of the solutions that we have for harmonic oscillators and therefore solve the quantum field theory by recycling the knowledge that we have of quantum harmonic oscillators. Okay, so after the infrared cutoff, after infrared regularization, Hamiltonian becomes a sum, a series. Infinitely many terms, but countably infinitely many terms. And then the canonical commutation relations, aha, have a Kronecker delta here instead of a Dirac delta. And the Klein-Gordon equation is unchanged. This equation is unchanged, except there's a bit of a change, which is that the k's are no longer taken from the R3 of momentum space. They're only taken from this discrete grid on momentum space. Well, so that looks already better. However, there is another difficulty. namely the hermeticity of it. You see, the Klein-Gordon field started out as a real-valued field, phi of x and t. Upon quantization, we require it to be self-adjoint operator valued. We require that at every x and t, this operator is equal to its adjoint. So it's a self-adjoint operator, right? Because those guys have real expectation values, real eigenvalues, so that's the quantum version of what classically is a real-valued function. And the same is true for the canonically conjugate field. It too is Hermitian operator value. But after the Fourier transform, it seems all of this is lost. Because after the Fourier transform, we have that if we take the adjoint of phi hat of k, then we get phi hat of minus k. This has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. This is, would be true even classically. If you take a real-valued function, and then you Fourier transform it, then if you're lucky, it's still real-valued. But generally, it's not real-valued. So for example, the Gaussian Fourier transformed is still a Gaussian. So it goes from real-valued to real-valued. But that's a rare exception. In general, the Fourier transform of a real-valued function is complex-valued. And what you have is that that function evaluated at k and then complex-conjugated is equal to the function evaluated at minus k. You may have seen that before. And it's easy to see why that is. Take phi k and take the dagger of it. So we have, that's the dagger of it, right? Because before we take the dagger, we have a minus ixk, and we have no dagger here. But if we put the dagger there, the Hermitian conjugation there, then this minus sign goes away, and we get a Hermitian conjugation there. So this is the same as that, you see, because we have a phi Hermitian conjugate of x and t, but that is self-adjoint. That's the position space one. That's self-adjoint, so we can write this as the phi, but the minus sign here doesn't change. So we can make up for that by absorbing that in the k, and then it's a phi hat of minus k. So what that means is that the Fourier transform of a self-adjoint valued field is no longer self-adjoint. Trouble. So that means that doesn't these two equations do not match what we would expect for an ordinary harmonic oscillator from quantum mechanics, because for those, the Q is self-adjoint and the P is self-adjoint. But ours are not Hermitian. And that has to do also with another trouble, if you look very closely. Let me look at the canonical commutation relations now. What we have is that the canonical commutation relation between phi and pi is not IH bar Kronecker delta of K and K prime. No, it's minus k prime, right? Or if you look at it over here, before we discretized, look at this. There's a problem here. You see, this thing should peak for k equal to k prime, but it doesn't. It peaks when k is equal to minus k prime. That's not how it is in quantum mechanics. So we still have to fix something here. Now, so as I said, the Fourier transformed quantum fields are no longer self-adjoint operator valued. And that also means that the canonical commutation relations are not IH bar when k is equal to k prime, but when k is equal to minus k prime. Now, I recommended as literature to read about this the book by Mukhanov and Vinitsky. And on the homepage of our course, there is a link to the PDF file of that book. And in that book, they neglect that. They just say, oh, it's just a complex-valued harmonic oscillator. And in a way, that's kind of justified, because if you have a complex-valued harmonic oscillator, then Well, the harmonic oscillator doesn't mix the real and the imaginary part. So you have a harmonic oscillator part that's for the real part and another one that's for the imaginary part. So in a way, yes, you can see how that works. But it's not clean, right? It's just hand waving. And I think it's good to actually go through it in detail and see what the matter is, because there is something very deep going on in here. This is not trivial that we have this issue with the Fourier factor. So how can we treat this properly? Remember what the mission that we are on. We want to solve the quantum field theory of the Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space by reducing it to just a bunch of ordinary harmonic oscillators, which we can quantize, where we have the solutions and all that. And what we saw is that we get these things here, the phi hat k and the pi hat k, for discrete values of k. And we found that they obey harmonic oscillator equations, independent ones. But the canonical commutation relations are messed up, and they're not Hermitian. So the mission now is to express these guys, the phi hat of k and the pi hat of k, in terms of operators qk and pk that actually, without any issues, directly obey harmonic oscillator equations. So let's do that. We define new variables, q hat k and p hat k, which are proper ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators. So we have that p is q dot, and we have the equation of motion that p dot is equal to minus omega squared q. And we have the ordinary harmonic oscillator and the ordinary canonical commutation relations between q and p. So their commutator is ih bar when k is equal to k prime. And we have the hermeticity condition. So this is what we really want to reduce it to. How can we do that? How can we reduce the quantum field theory to a bunch of those? And for this, to achieve this, here is an answer. Let's try this. What is this? Well, we write the field as 1/2 and then a q hat k plus q hat minus k plus I times I over 2 omega k, and then the pk minus p hat minus k. And you see, yeah, this guy is not self-adjoint, because this part is self-adjoint. It's just the sum of two self-adjoint operators. But that's I times a self-adjoint thing, because that's the difference between two self-adjoint operators. So the whole thing is not self-adjoint, because it has a Hermitian part and an anti-Hermitian part. But you may wonder, why the heck, where does this come from? Right? We didn't derive this. I'm just claiming that this is going to work. Now, we will now check that this works. But then you would have to ask, does it have to be this? Could it be something else? And very importantly, yes, it could also be something else. There are other ways to do this as well. Now, in Minkowski space, there's just one way to do it right, and it's this one. But as we will see today and then later in the course, this is a highly non-trivial thing that's underlying this. If we want to reduce a quantum field to a bunch of ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators that are independent and obey the proper relationships, just like these, then there's an ambiguity in this. And that ambiguity translates into the ambiguity of identifying what the vacuum state is of a quantum field. You might think, it's easy. The vacuum state is the state without particles. And then you might say, how do I know that it's a state without particles? Then you might say, it's a state with lowest energy. I know how to do that. It's that state which has the lowest eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian, right? But it turns out that those two states are not necessarily the same. The state of lowest energy, the lowest eigenvalue, eigenvector of the Hamiltonian of a quantum field, is not necessarily the vacuum state. It's not necessarily the state without particles. Very subtle thing, and it will take us quite a while to figure out how that works. But for now, let let's just have that in our back of our minds, that the state without particles need not be the state of lowest energy. Weird thing, but that's how it is. And that plays a huge role in cosmic inflation and in Hawking radiation and in so on and so on. All right, so this is one ansatz. And for Minkowski space, it's the winning ansatz. For other backgrounds, there can be different observers that do different things. For example, you might be in a black hole, outside a black hole, before the black hole formed. You might be observing this after the black hole formed. And then you will have different different ansatzes that you work out at that point. All right, so we try this ansatz here. And it looks a little complicated and a little bit contrived. But it looks much easier if I show it to you in an equivalent formulation that looks perhaps way more familiar to you. Namely, do you remember that for ordinary harmonic oscillators, you can define creation and annihilation operators, or raising and lowering operators? And here they are. These are just ordinary harmonic oscillators. And for these QK and PK, you can define AK and AK dagger raising and lowering operators, which are, you know, square root of omega k times the position plus I over square root of omega k times the momentum, and then it's canonically, and then it's Hermitian conjugate, a dagger k is, you know, what you get when you put a minus sign in here. Now, if you express that ansatz, which looks a little lengthy, admittedly, in terms of the A and the A dagger, then this ansatz becomes simply that phi hat k is 1 over square root of 2 omega k times ak plus a dagger minus k. That's what it is. Looks very simple now, right? And you see, yeah, that's not Hermitian, because it's not ak plus a dagger k. If it was ak plus a dagger k, well, then it would be self-adjoint, right? It's an operator plus its Hermitian conjugate. That would be self-adjoint. But it's ak plus a minus k dagger, right? And that's not Hermitian. Instead, what happens if I Hermitian conjugate that? What happens? Well, the Hermitian conjugation goes away here, but here I get a Hermitian conjugation. So that means that I get the same terms, but k and minus k are now swapped. Which means if I take the Hermitian conjugate of this, I get the same as before, but with k replaced by minus k. And that's what we needed, right? That's what we get after the Fourier transform. All right, so we make this ansatz here, and that ansatz succeeds. If we make that ansatz, then the Hamiltonian takes this form. And look at it. It's just ordinary harmonic oscillators just added up. And the equations of motion are just the ordinary equations of motion without anything weird going on with minus signs, Dirac deltas going to infinity, or any of that kind. And the canonical commutation relations are also fine. Or are they? yes, they are kind of fine, right? You just need to know that the canonically conjugate operator to the phi k is not the pi k, it's the pi of minus k. But other than that, everything is fine. And that's just a renaming. You could also rename those pi hat k's. You could rename them pi tilde hat minus k. And then everything would be exactly the same. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this roughly looks like a Bogoliubov transformation, is that?
The Bogoliubov transformation is what you get if you go from one ansatz to another ansatz.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, we will see that in great detail, of course. Okay, and here I make the remark that this ansatz A was not unique. And the X and the P's could be mixed, the Q's and the P's could be mixed in different ways, and you could still represent everything, but in terms of different harmonic oscillators, different ways of expressing the whole thing. So that will come up. This sort of thing, these issues never come up if you study just particle physics. If you study the standard model of particle physics, then yeah, this is the way to go. That's the way to go. That's it. Why worry about anything else? these issues, the ambiguity in this, ambiguity in that, and so on, that only comes up when you have gravity involved or accelerations involved. Then that comes up. But that's what this course is all about. Okay. And then I wanted to show you how the field, the self-adjoint valued original field, phi hat, is expressed. It also depends on time, of course, but how it is expressed now in terms of the q hat and the p hat. And if you plug everything in there and work it all out, you find that it is expressed in this way. It's the sum of these cosine and sine terms with these ordinary harmonic oscillators q hat and p hat. So it's not so complicated after all. All right, so what was the significance of the non-uniqueness? I can only anticipate it for now. The ground state of these Q and P oscillators will be identified with the vacuum state, with the no particle states. But that need not be the lowest energy state of the quantum, of the full quantum theory, of the full quantum field theory. And that leads us to the problem of identifying the vacuum state in curved space-time, something that we will deal with later on in this course very carefully. So for now, what we did is we used this ansatz to solve the quantum field theory. How did we do that? Well, let's connect the dots. What we achieved is that we by doing a Fourier transform and by doing infrared cutoff and by doing this by expressing phi hat in terms of the Qs and the Ps, we have reduced the quantum field theoretical equations to a bunch of equations for ordinary harmonic oscillators. And at that point, we stopped. Not really because we were done, but because at this point we can just import what we know from the quantum mechanics of harmonic oscillators to solve the quantum field theory. So each harmonic oscillator now, we can ask, for each one of them, we can ask, well, what state is it in? And what is its evolution? And so on. And the full quantum field theory has as its Hilbert space the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of all those individual harmonic oscillators. So in principle, we can now calculate everything because we've reduced the entire quantum field theory just to infinitely many ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators, each of which we can assume that we know all about.
Can you talk a little bit more about the ansatz? Like, if I mean, what's the background? How does one come up with this?
Oh, with this ansatz here?
Yeah. It seems, well, not completely random, but.
No, what you can do is you can write down the phi hat as a linear combination of all possible Qs, all possible Ps, right? With coefficients in front, with coefficient matrices. Because here you have a vector of these phi k's, and then you have a vector of all the Qs, a vector of all the Ps, and then you have matrices, right? So you have vector is equal to matrix times the Q vector plus matrix times the P vector. And then you plug that into the equations, and you require stuff, right? So you require that, you know, that the Qs and the Ps obey this, the phi obey their thing, and then you get conditions on the matrices. And then you check for solutions for that, and you find this is one solution, but there are more. So that means that the quantum field theory can be reduced to harmonic oscillators in many different ways. And ordinarily, that would not be an issue. If you have a system that you can decompose into multiple harmonic oscillators, perhaps in multiple different ways, not a problem. It's the same physical situation. But what is a problem is that in quantum field theory, harmonic oscillators define the particles. If the harmonic oscillator is in its ground state, there is no particle. If the harmonic oscillator is in the first excited state, there is one particle, which has the momentum of that harmonic oscillator, has that k, right, and so on. So that means that in principle, ordinarily, well, if you can decompose a quantum mechanical system into subsystems, fine. It doesn't matter how you decompose into subsystems. But in quantum field theory, These subsystems, if they're harmonic oscillators, they define what are particles, and in particular define what is the vacuum, what is the no particle state. And therefore, that ambiguity matters. Not for the dynamics of the operators, really. It matters for what is the no particle state, what is the vacuum state. All right, so what was the significance of the non-uniqueness? The ground state of the harmonic oscillators is ambiguous if it's not unique. I mean, if it's ambiguous how we decompose into harmonic oscillators, then it's ambiguous what is the state of the lowest energy of the lowest states of all these harmonic oscillators. They may not be the lowest energy state of the total system. And in curved space and for accelerations, this becomes a non-trivial issue. All right, so we solved using this ansatz, the problem, by reducing the entire quantum field theoretical problem, namely equations of motion, secondly, the canonical commutation relations, and thirdly, the hermeticity conditions. We solved them implicitly by reducing everything to a bunch of ordinary harmonic oscillators. So we have solved the equations of motions, the hermeticity, and the canonical commutation relations. Remember, in quantum field theory, the challenge is always to solve these three things: equations of motion, hermeticity, and commutation relations. So now, how, once we have this, now once we have reduced the quantum field theory to a bunch of ordinary uncoupled harmonic oscillators, now we should be able to calculate things. For example, we should be able to calculate the vacuum fluctuations of a quantum field. Because remember what they are. We said that, let me go up here. Right. If we leave, if we have a swimming pool and nobody swims, after a while there won't be any waves, ground state. A quantum field is never like that. A quantum field is always agitated. And why is that? Well, it's because at every point we have a harmonic oscillator, but it's a quantum harmonic oscillator. And quantum harmonic oscillators always fluctuate. There is no state in which the elongation of the harmonic oscillator would be zero and the momentum is zero. The thing is always moving, it's always jittery, right? And we should expect that to be the case also for the quantum fields. And it is the case. And so what we can ask then is, if we take a quantum field and we do not excite it, it's like a swimming pool that nobody swims in, then if we were to measure as a snapshot in time, if we were to measure the amplitude of the field, the scalar field, at every position, then we should expect that the amplitude is not zero. It should be sometimes positive, sometimes negative. Maybe in some places it's close to zero, but in general, it's some wavy thing. How does it look? Does it look like this, or how does it look? Now, how do we calculate that? Well, in principle, since we have reduced everything to harmonic oscillators, we should be able to calculate that now. Okay. So how can we calculate the quantum fluctuations of a Klein-Gordon field, for example? Well, all we need to do is solve infinitely many quantum harmonic oscillators. It sounds worse than it is, right? Because each one is just works the same way as any other. So we solve these infinitely many quantum harmonic oscillators. So the Qs and the Ps, remember, they have this Hamiltonian. The K values are taken from this grid of momenta. And so we get these, the K vectors are taken from this grid in momentum space. And so we get this discrete set of omega values. And then we choose a state of the total quantum system. So for each of the harmonic oscillators, we choose a state. For example, we can choose for each of the harmonic oscillator, of these harmonic oscillators, we can choose its ground state. And that, in Minkowski space, this would just be the lowest energy state. This is the vacuum state, the no particle state. So let's say we choose all the oscillators in the lowest energy state. It's like the swimming pool where nobody swam in it for a while. except it's a quantum swimming pool, so we expect there to be waves. Now, we call this psi vector, that is jointly the ground state of all these harmonic oscillators, let's call this psi vector the vacuum state preliminarily. For Minkowski space, that's true. Then, given that state, we can calculate the probability distribution or the probability amplitude density for finding arbitrary values of Q and P. You know, we can write down what is the wave function, what's the probability distribution for particular values of Q and particular values of P, if you want. For example, for the harmonic oscillator's ground state, it's a Gaussian, of course. And if we take the modulus square of this, then we get the actual probability density. And it goes like this, e to the power minus omega k q squared. Now, remember we reduced the quantum field theory of the Klein-Gordon field to just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And that means that if we know what the probability distribution is of the values of these harmonic oscillators, of these Qs and these Ps, then from there, by just going all the way back by doing the reverse Fourier transform, we can calculate what the probability distribution is for the Fourier coefficients of the field. So we take the Klein-Gordon field, and we Fourier transform it, and then we get all these Fourier coefficients. These Fourier coefficients, these phi hat k, are operator values. But we express those operators in terms of these simple harmonic oscillators. Now, ultimately, what we want to do is to take a snapshot of the quantum swimming pool. And what we would expect it to look is something like this. Right? So that there's some, I'm drawing here contour lines, something like that, right? How do we do that? Well, what you can do is, well, this would be phi of x, right? But if we Fourier transform it, then what we, this is a classical description. After we do a measurement, we get a classical field. So we get phi of x. And then after we do the Fourier transform, we get phi of k. I mean, this is of t, but we take a snapshot in time. So we have phi k. And these k vectors are from a discrete grid. And we have that the phi of x is the sum over, there's a coefficient. And then we have the sum over ei x k. And then you have these phi k coefficients here. Right? It's the inverse Fourier series. So if we can calculate these phi k, then we can calculate the phi of x and we can plot it. Now the phi k, in turn, I expressed in terms of the q k and the q minus k. Right? We had a formula for this. It was complicated. The answer is A. So again, if we get these numbers, the Fourier coefficients, we can do the Fourier inverse Fourier transform, we get the phi of x, and we can plot it. So how do we get these coefficients? Well, they are linearly expressed in terms of these guys. And these are just the position operators of ordinary harmonic oscillators. And their probability distribution is a Gaussian. So what we can do is we can draw from that Gaussian probability distribution for each one of the Q and get random real numbers for that. And these random real numbers go into this formula to produce a Fourier coefficient, which is complex because, you know, there's going to be i's in there. And so now we get random numbers in here. And these, you know, they follow statistics governed by the statistics of the quantum wave function of the harmonic oscillators. So we have these coefficients, complex numbers. We plug them into here, and we get the phi of x. So the probability for finding a particular value phi k, if we measured the amplitude of the Klein-Gordon field at every point in space at a snapshot in time, that probability distribution is proportional to e to the power minus omega k, and then that. That's just something that comes out. I'm going very fast here. So you can do that, and in fact, I have set the challenge to actually produce such pictures as a project in previous offerings of this course, and I'm considering to do that again. Of course, I give you detailed instructions of how to actually do these calculations, and you can produce pictures of quantum fluctuations. And what you then end up with is a picture like this, here on the left, a picture like that. So again, it's drawn in the following way. You take the ordinary harmonic oscillators with their probability distribution in the ground state, just a Gaussian, and you draw from that Gaussian distribution. You get some random numbers, one for each harmonic oscillator. And then for each one of these coefficients, you get one of those coefficients. From that, you get eventually that, and that you can plot. A previous student of this course, PhD student of mine, did this as a project. And then later, he remembered the project. And he had those random numbers not chosen by Mathematica or Python or something using that routine. No, he used the Google quantum computer to actually draw those random numbers and then plotted that. And on 1st of April 2020, he sold it for $10,000 as an NFT. And he said it's the first picture of quantum fluctuations made from quantum fluctuations. Anyway, there's money in this. I don't think you can still sell it. He scooped you on this.
The money was real? Or
the money was real. Anyway. Yeah. Okay, so that's as far as we got today. We will do some other wild things in the next lecture, and then we will go into calmer waters where we will systematically build everything up so that you can calculate these things, and not only for Minkowski space, but also for expanding space times and, if you like, black holes and that sort of thing. And also, not only for the vacuum, but for example, you know, you can ask, how does this quantum swimming pool look if there's a particle in there? Right? Put a particle in there and then see how the quantum fluctuations change. That sort of thing will be the project.
It seems like it's still infinite. So do you truncate, or how do you?
What is infinite?
The Fourier series.
Oh, yes, yes. That's right. Good point. You anticipated the right thing. What we need to do in order to calculate the plot like this is not only an infrared cutoff. You need an infrared cutoff so that you have a discrete set of harmonic oscillators instead of having a continuum of them. But also, you need to put an ultraviolet cutoff, meaning that we are not only saying that we have no wavelength larger than what the image gives us, but also we cut off the smallest wavelength. And we say, no, we don't consider wavelengths smaller than such and such. There are technical reasons for that and physical reasons. The physical reasons, there's a lot to say about. And in the course of this course, we will see what that relates to. But mathematically, we need that exactly because, as you say, this would actually add up to an infinity here. If we did not put an ultraviolet cutoff, if we did not put a short wavelength cutoff, then these fluctuations would pile up more and more, and we would find that they would become more and more detailed, but the overall amplitude would just diverge. Now, you might say, OK, but that's a sick theory then. It kind of is, but it's fixable. And we will do that in great detail, but I can already anticipate for you how that will work. In order to see these divergences, you would actually have, experimentally, you would actually have to be able to measure the amplitude at a point. And you would find that it infinitely fluctuates. However, nobody can measure the amplitude at a point. The best you can do is use some measurement instrument that has some spatial resolution, and a finite spatial resolution, of course. And then you will find, you will measure the average of the field over some little volume. But when you average the field over some little volume, then the fluctuations are actually finite. And that's because neighboring amplitudes closely neighboring amplitudes will be canceling each other out to some extent so that the average is actually smooth and well behaved. We will study exactly how the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations that you observe are dependent on the size of the region over which you are averaging. This will be a central instrument in mathematical instrument in making predictions for the quantum fluctuations that in the standard model of cosmology are thought to have seeded the formation of a structure in the universe in the form of the inhomogeneities in the distribution of the primordial hydrogen that then coalesced into galaxies and into stars. Yeah, so that was the whole purpose of going through these things already, so that you see roughly what's going on with quantum field theory and what the pitfalls are, where we have to be careful, and where technical issues already at that level indicate that there is something deeper going on, that which is the reason why we need an entire course and can't just do it on in 3 hours. Okay?
This is a follow-up question to a previous question that was brought up during the answers of
equation A. Yeah, I remember.
A and A dagger. The discussion continued with the bubble loop of transformation. I was wondering if we have the same A and A dagger annihilator and the creation operator if we do the transformation and come up with a new choice of the ansatz.
Well, exactly. That's the point. A different ansatz means different A and A daggers.
And
the Bogoliubov transformation is a transformation between different ansatzes, but it's also, at the same time, a transformation between different choices of A and A daggers.
And would that different A and A dagger, would that represent something physically different?
Yeah. Yes, because if you have, you see, you can define the vacuum state as the state that's annihilated by all of the A operators. But if you have different A operators, they annihilate a different state. And so you can get a different definition of the vacuum there. And the mathematics of it, as we will later see, the mathematics of it is the mathematics of the diagonalization of a matrix. Now you might think, oh, I've seen that before. I have diagonalized the one or the other matrix in my time, right? No, not this one. It's a different kind. Normally, what you diagonalize is a unitary matrix. You know, then you know all its eigenvalues are phases. They're all complex numbers of modulus 1. Or you're diagonalizing self-adjoint matrices. And then you know beforehand that all the eigenvalues are real. But no, this is going to be a symplectic matrix. And there it's different. The whole diagonalization game works differently. And that's how that's the math that's really underneath all of that, as we will see later on.
Mm-hmm. So when we do the infrared cutoff, are we again introducing an assumption of locality here? This is the second point.
Because are you talking about the infrared or ultraviolet now?
The infrared, because we are assuming the boundary conditions. And the thing that happens in the boundary is affecting what is happening over
yes.
here. So this is the second point, I guess, where we have again assumed the locality, apart from the commutation relations.
Oh, the commutation relations are local, that's right. The equations of motion are local, too.
This is the second point where we have introduced the assumption of locality.
Yes, that is right. We assume that, yes. In principle, there could be action at a distance. But there's no evidence for that, so we assume that there isn't.
I mean, isn't it again the spirit of Bell's theorem with the...
Of what theorem?
With Bell's theorem.
Ah, Bell's theorem. Yeah, entanglement, yes. It's not really action, though, right? It's in hindsight, you see that there was a correlation. But, you know, you can't use a violation of Bell's inequality to actually transmit information or to affect some action. You can't remote control a plane by using Bell's inequality violation. Okay, let's officially end the lecture here, but we can keep discussing, of course.